This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I don't know who it was who said business and economic news get slow in August, but boy, were they wrong, huh? China, Google, and a bunch of other stuff to go over from the past 5 days from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a Friday. This one's the 14th of August. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It has been a week. This one has. China, for starters. A couple other things as well, as I mentioned. Fodder, one might say, for a weekly wrap-up. For that, we've got Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Also, Sudeep Reddy. He is at The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so Catherine, we're going to start with you. The topic is China. You wrote about it this morning, the devaluation of the yuan that's been going on. Big deal, not big deal, and why? Discuss.
Not as big of a deal as many people have made it out to be, given the magnitude of the change. I mean, we're talking like a few percentage points.
Yep.
It's not the end of the world. I would say it's a big deal in terms of their change in policy, that basically for decades, the United States, the IMF, and other international actors have basically been trying to get China to move towards a more market-based currency, you know, basically letting markets determine how the renminbi or yuan should trade rather than just by, like, government fiat. And they're moving in that direction, and that's a very big deal.
However, Sudeep, if Congress had been in town this week, we would have heard currency wars being bellowed from the halls of Congress.
Oh, you absolutely would, because there's no better bogeyman than China, and for all sorts of reasons, because of hacking concerns, because of security concerns. And in this case, China just picked the perfect time to start playing by everyone else's rules. It's the perfect time when its economy is weak, moving to a market-oriented exchange rate, when it weakens your currency and it helps your exports. That's really the easy part. The real test is going to be when it so happens that the markets push up your currency, and then you have to see whether you're willing to sustain that. So we could look back at this moment at a time when China joined the rest of the world and started playing by everyone else's currency rules, or it's just another moment when China pulled a fast one and prevailed.
Quick little detour on that, Catherine, from your piece today, pointing out that the American dollar has been so strong because the U.S. is so strong economically compared to the rest of the world, even though it might not feel like it to a lot of people here.
Yeah, I mean, I know it feels like our economy, our recovery have not been so great, but could be worse, certainly, if you look at Europe, if you look at Japan. China's growing, but it's decelerating. And there are a few reasons for that. One, especially relative to Europe, is that our monetary policy was much more active earlier on. Our fiscal policy, even though we had some austerity measures, we didn't have the same kinds of major cuts that countries like Greece have had, and Spain and elsewhere, which is partly because people were still willing to lend to us. You know, there was sort of this flight to safety where investors around the world were buying dollars. So they were buying U.S. debt, essentially. So we didn't have to face those tough choices. So there are a number of reasons. Also, we deleveraged a lot more than other countries did.
Quickly, Sudeep, on the Greece thing, the final bailout was agreed to today. Anything more to say on that? And this can be a yes or no answer.
Not much more. They've kicked the can. We've been waiting for it, and they did it, and we'll have more of this to come.
Fair enough. Corporate news of the week, Sudeep, the Google Alphabet thing. It's the holding company now, and Google is going to be sort of broken out and more transparent. How much do you think that's going to help that company actually make more money? Is it that big a deal?
It's probably not that big of a deal to all of us, but it should help Google figure out what it wants to be. It's in a weird moment. It's been around for almost two decades, and it could easily end up being like a Microsoft, a powerful, successful, profitable company that has what you might consider incremental innovation, even mm-hmm. though it's a core part of the economy. What it really wants, what you're hearing from the founders and from everyone else there, is they want to be a perpetual startup. They want to have that mentality that they're taking much larger leaps. They want to be on the forefront of what the economy needs. And this might help them orient themselves and organize themselves to get there with all the cool things that they're working on and all the things that probably aren't mm-hmm. going to make any money anytime soon.
Catherine, last question to you. It's a commodities question, and it's a quickie. Oil at $42 a barrel and falling. Are you surprised? And when are we going to start feeling it, right?
Am I surprised? I mean, there have been a number of factors that suggested we were heading in this direction, including China's slowdown, as we talked about
right.
before. And, you know, the talks with Iran probably are going to increase the supply of oil, mm-hmm. or at least mm-hmm. that's what people are expecting. In terms of when we'll feel it, well, right now gas prices have spiked, at least in some parts of the country, but that's mostly because refineries have been out. So, you know, if you're talking about when consumers are going to feel it, there's that middle step in the process
yeah.
that may prevent us from noticing it too much anytime soon.
Especially out here in L.A., I will tell you that. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, not so bad, actually. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Among life's great unanswered questions is this one. Why, oh why, has it been so hard for Apple to figure out how to do TV right? I mean, they've been talking about it for years, and no, the current incarnation of what is called the Apple TV right now doesn't count. That's just a set-top box. We are talking here about live TV delivered over the internet straight to your device of choice. There has been some speculation of late that Apple would make the big announcement next month, just in time for the glut of fall shows headed our way. Bloomberg, however, reports today that that is not going to happen. So we sent Marketplace's Adrian Hill off to figure out why it has been so difficult for Apple to get that deal done.
Usually, Apple gets what Apple wants. This time around, it's live TV streaming over the internet for somewhere in the neighborhood of $40 a month, less than a lot of us pay for our cable. It sounds simple enough.
What they're doing is not easy. In fact, it's very complex.
Life never easy. Mark Thayer is the author of the book Televisionaries. He says there are technical issues to solve. No one wants glitchy TV. Also, Apple has to get the rights to actually stream the content from Fox, CBS, NBC, ABC, and potentially the local affiliates of those networks.
And that requires licensing with each individual content provider that they want to include and making sure that the terms and conditions are such that Apple can get a return on its investment at some point.
But for Apple, getting that return on investment could be tough. Certainly not as simple as it was when it launched iTunes. John Butler is senior analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
They're not in as good a position as they were when they were negotiating contracts with the music industry.
When iTunes launched, he says the music industry was capital D desperate.
They were facing the loss of music through free services like Napster.
Television providers, on the other hand,
they hold all the cards. I mean, content really is king.
It's textbook catbird seat, and content providers are thinking about their own bottom line, looking for a good deal. Not just any deal. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Today's Marketplace quiz has only one question on it. Here you go. What group of Americans holds 70% of our collective disposable income? Is it lawyers, bankers, doctors? Actually, the answer is not so much career-based as it is age-based. It's people over 50, which is why next week a new marketing company is going to launch to target that demographic. It's a company connected to an organization you might have heard of called AARP. Can you say corporate synergy? Marketplace's Scott Tong sure can.
The new marketing firm is called Influent 50, and it's part of AARP's for-profit subsidiary. This is a great opportunity to reach a wealthy, ignored demographic. Just 10% of marketing money targets people over 50.
There's also an opportunity to not be good at it.
Lori Bitter at the Business of Aging Consultancy says this is a hard group to target well. As we age, she says, our buying psychology changes. We no longer want, say, BMW to tell us what the ultimate driving machine is. We want Apple to suggest that we think different.
It's allowing us to think for ourselves as opposed to being told what the product is all about.
She and others say marketers have been tripping over a few myths about older adults. One, that they don't spend any money. And two, that they're overly brand loyal. Chuck Nyren is an advertising consultant.
I'm not going to buy a different brand of mayonnaise. I like my mayonnaise. But everything else is open, and people go to the store, and they're constantly looking for something different.
Oh, and one other myth, that they want to be treated as old. We are talking about 50-somethings in this demographic. I asked Paul Gilbert at the agency Register Media for an example of what works.
The new Viagra spots. It's a woman, probably 40s, 50s. Think about the sophistication. It is great views and written for that boomer mindset.
The marketing firm out of AARP wants to reach boomers in the initial areas of travel and insurance. But eventually, yes, pharmaceuticals. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we had to wonder just how lucky we were that we waited in line to buy that Labatt's beer there and settling for the Miller Lite.
It is true, beer can be good luck. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 69 points today, 0.4%, 17,477. The NASDAQ up 14 points, 0.25%, 5,048. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.4%, 2,091, the number there. For the week gone by, the Dow up 0.6%, the NASDAQ added 0.1%, the S&P 500 up 0.7%. El Pollo Loco said the number of people coming to its restaurants declined for the first time since the chain went public last year. Sales thus missed expectations, and shares in ticker symbol LOCO went on a crash diet off 20%. You still playing Candy Crush on your phone? Yes, Stacey Vanek-Smith, I'm looking at you. The game's maker King Digital says revenue is slipping. Thus, it's going to take longer than expected to bring new games to market. Shares in King declined 11%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Estee Lauder is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And too much of a good thing is wonderful. We have writer and stage and screen star Mae West to thank for that phrase and so many others. She was born on August 17, 1893. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 100 years ago, department stores like Macy's and Marshall Field's weren't just thriving retailers. They were local icons among the most important places in town. Two or three retail generations later, which saw the rise of suburban malls and discounters like Walmart and online commerce, oh yeah, my, how things have changed. The latest retail numbers show increases in almost every category of store save three. Gas stations, electronics, and the once mighty department store. Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at the past, present, and possible future of a retail institution.
At their peak, department stores weren't just places to buy stuff. They were places to go and do everything, especially for women. Jan Whitaker is author of Service and Style, How the American Department Store Fashioned the Middle Class.
When women went shopping there, they might spend hours inside an individual store, especially if they ate lunch or they went to the hairdresser or
paid the utility bills or brought a watch in to get repaired or consulted with the decorator or visited the travel agent to plan a trip.
There were so many possibilities there that could consume your time.
Not every consumer's dream anymore. Whitaker says the rise in women's employment was as big a factor as any in shifting the market. Discounters like Walmart were open in the evening. Today, Oliver Chen says Nordstrom's may be the bright light among department stores. He's an analyst with Cowen and Company. Nordstrom has a thriving website, the discount arm Nordstrom Rack, and a strong rep for selection and service. But is Nordstrom really a department store? I asked Chen, can you even buy a coffee maker there or a suitcase or dishes?
I don't even know the answer to that, to be frank.
Turns out it's no. But he says women's clothes are the bread and butter for Macy's, too. And that's where department stores have their advantage, having the merchandise right there and lots of it where you can try it on, like those skinny jeans.
Or that stretch denim. And you might want to look at that stretch.
And see if it's really a match with that top before you decide to buy. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
I say, National Labor Relations Board, you get ready for some snoozer of a story about employment law. I get that, totally. No offense to employment lawyers intended here. But there is a case before the NLRB right now that's going to be felt way beyond the immediate parties to it. Marketplace's Mark Garrison is on it.
It's all about employees working for subcontractors or franchisees. It's a case with sharp points of disagreement, but there are some key points of consensus.
That's going to have big implications for the economy as a whole.
That's Angelo Amador of the National Restaurant Association, who gives an industry perspective. And here's Bob Bruno, a University of Illinois labor relations professor, sympathetic to unions.
It's potentially a big deal because it can redefine who an employer is under federal labor law.
All sides agree this decision will be huge because of what's at stake. Think of a big corporation that hires a company to clean its building, or a burger chain that franchises. Right now, workers can't collectively bargain with the corporation or fast food chain, only the subcontractor or franchisee. Unions don't like that. Michael Wasser is with the pro-union group Jobs with Justice.
Labor standards, our protections for workers haven't kept pace, and this is an opportunity simply to modernize the rules so that they keep the spirit of the law intact.
Of course, whether it's a good idea to change things is where the disagreement begins. Various industries are against this because they don't want to be liable for subcontractors and franchisees. Marilyn Pearson is a partner at DLA Piper, who advises corporate clients on labor issues.
This will be so disruptive to those relationships. And what the board is suggesting it may go to would have really significant impact.
Companies argue making them responsible for contractors would strangle profits and ultimately hurt jobs. Unions believe such a move would create a better environment for workers. One final point of agreement, we may soon find out who's right. The labor board leans Democratic. Observers on all sides are betting it'll rule in favor of the unions soon. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Today in global economic facts you may not have been aware of, this item: the United States and Japan have never had a free trade agreement with one another. That would change if, and we should stress the if here, if a dozen countries, including the U.S. and Japan, can find a way to come to terms on the big trade deal that's been in the works for years now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. The latest set of negotiations on that thing wrapped up a couple of weeks ago out in Hawaii without a deal. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson was there, and she has this story on the high hopes and hurdles when it comes to selling to Japan.
While TPP negotiators on one Hawaiian island tried to hash out rules that will govern about a third of global trade, John Holman was on another island, opening up a PowerPoint presentation.
Why should you export? We already have some exporters in the room.
Holman works for the U.S. Commercial Service. He's the guy on the ground trying to get companies interested in exporting and helping them figure out how. He tells me when people come to him, they often have dreams of selling to Japan and China. His message? Look for the path of least resistance.
So what markets can you get into as an exporter in the shortest amount of time, the least amount of cost, and generate the greatest return? And then reinvest that revenue and experience into new markets.
He pulls up the World Bank's global rankings for ease of doing business. Japan is number 29. As the world's third largest economy with a wealthy consumer class, Japan is a tempting target for companies. Plus, in tariff terms, it's actually a pretty open market, though there are certainly exceptions. Rice imports, for example, above a certain quota, face tariffs over 700%.
But that's not all. There are also other kinds of unique regulations that make it very hard to do business in Japan, much harder than in other advanced economies.
Peter Petrie is a professor at Brandeis University. He says we're mostly talking about four main areas: agriculture, medicine, foreign investment, and services, like insurance or internet providers.
But in these areas where there is a great deal of regulatory intervention, Japan is really pretty far behind. And one way to see that is that the amount of investment going into Japan is, in our estimates, maybe one-third as much as we would predict for Japan.
U.S. automakers also complain they face unfair regulations and exchange rates when trying to sell to Japan. So Petri says the TPP's biggest economic impact won't come from lowering tariffs, but from addressing these other rules and regulations, making them more uniform across various countries. That would be welcome news for lots of exporters, but some are still skeptical.
If you look at the farm, if you can look down there.
Rodrigo Balala drives me up the dusty, rutted roads of the 1,200-acre hilltop pineapple farm he manages in Maui. Hawaii used to be a major player in the global pineapple market, but dropped away with the rise of cheaper labor and lower prices elsewhere, a common story in global trade. He stops the truck and points out across the valley to the ocean beyond.
Every pineapple has a view over here.
Most of these pineapples will stay in Hawaii. He sells a bit to Los Angeles, and he's also started exporting to Japan.
Japan pays for quality. If you can put a quality product out there, they're willing to buy it. Can you want to step out and taste it?
Yeah. He hacks a pineapple off a spiny bush by the side of the road and skins it easily. It's sweet, juicy, not at all acidic. And that, he says, is how the Japanese like it. Sure, selling to Japan that first time was tricky.
There's a lot of stuff we had to learn. We thought we knew all we needed to know, but you know, there's a list of paperwork you gotta do.
He says now it's not so bad, if you work with someone on the other side who knows what they're doing. Plus, his importer covers the roughly 20% tariff. But even while Rodrigo might benefit from lower tariffs and a smoother exporting process, he looks at past trade deals and is unsure about the TPP. He's worried about increased competition from abroad.
It hurts, especially if they can come in cheap. I mean, because everybody knows the cost of producing stuff in the United States is expensive. Hopefully it doesn't hurt us that way.
For him, there's risks and reward to trade. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Some of the best stories of our lives involve buying something, the simple exchange of money for stuff. That's why we started a series a while back called The Transaction, You and How a Purchase, Big or Small, Changed You in Some Way. Today, that story comes out of North Carolina.
My name is Mark Byrne from Conover, North Carolina, originally from Michigan, though. And my transaction had to do with buying a $4 beer at Michigan International Speedway. It was the summer of 1998. Being NASCAR fans, we were familiar with going to Michigan International Speedway and catching the NASCAR races quite a bit. It wasn't a NASCAR race, but it was the IndyCar race, so me and my buddy Ryan decided to go. We headed out over there, and when we got to the parking lot, there were two people walking out. They said they had to go somewhere, but they had good seats and wondered if we wanted their tickets, and we said, sure, we'll check them out. When we got up to the gate, sure enough, their seats were pretty good. They were in turn four, which is a nice place to be where you can see the cars coming at you and going away. And so we decided to go check out those seats first. On our way there, we stopped at the beer stand, and we had a choice of Miller Lite or Labatt's Blue, and we decided we wanted Labatt's Blue, being more fans of that than Miller Lite. To our surprise, the keg was empty, and the guy asked if we wanted to wait for the new keg. He said it'd just be a few minutes. They were already going to get it and all that, and not being huge Miller Lite fans, we both said, yeah. While we were sitting there waiting, started noticing a police officer and a couple emergency responders going by, and next thing you know, there was a few more and then a few more. It got to be about 30 of them that ended up going by. In the meantime, the keg showed up, so we got our two Labatts and headed towards our seats. When we got to that section, we noticed the section was closed, so we figured we'd just head over to our other seats. This is time before all the smartphones and all that, so we couldn't just check our phones and see what happened or anything. We ended up watching the rest of the race, and on the way home, we're listening to the radio recap and all that, and to our surprise, we found out that Adrian Fernandez had crashed in turn four, and basically some parts of his car had flown into the seats. Several people had been injured and three people had been killed. People who had been killed had been sitting in row 8 and row 10. Having our seats being in row 9 in that section, we had to wonder just how lucky we were that we waited in line to buy that Labatt's beer there instead of settling for the Miller Lite. Might have helped save our lives that day.
If you've got a story of a transaction that led to something unexpected, there is a spot on our website where you can tell us about it, and please do. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, in which, for all the macroeconomic tsuris that their government has given us this week, you really got to tip your hat to the entrepreneurial spirit of the Chinese people. A farmer in Shandong province in eastern China had an idea, and he ran with it. What if, he thought, I opened a fake branch of the China Construction Bank, complete with card readers and account passbooks and staff and all that, but only took in deposits? Nice, right? When somebody came in to withdraw, he came up with one excuse or another not to give them their money back. Of course, he got caught. He did wind up returning all the people's money, but still, pretty good, right? Friday has come and mostly gone, which means we will too. The Dow up 69 points today, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 0.4% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Liederman. Sitar Nieves is the senior producer of this program. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer thereof. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a nice weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.